Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'll give you a moment to get settled. We're just lucky everyone made it here on time this morning. Well, welcome. I know both of you are familiar with the court, but just as a reminder, each of you will have 15 minutes for your arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you come to the podium, please introduce yourself each time so that the audio recording will be clear who's talking. And you can, there's a button on the podium, you can raise or lower to suit your needs. And with that, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, I should say. May it please the court and counsel, who I know had a long drive here today. Glad she made it. What's in front of you is a case that you seem to see fairly often here at the Court of Appeals, fortunately or unfortunately. And I think this is a simple issue. The district court focused, without referencing Henson, which was decided here and then up to the Supreme Court and laid this out even more focused, that an individual who is escorted out of a bar at the direction of the bar, or at least there are fact disputes, and that's the first thing I'm going to say in front of you today, Your Honors. There are fact disputes all over the place on every material fact. The district court took this and said, made a decision of law. The decision of the law was based on an incorrect standard. Mr. Friesen was at the bar drinking with some people who were classmates, some people who were actually bar employees themselves, some people who had spouses in the bar.
I think we understand the facts. What I'm curious about is you're saying that the question is really foreseeability and not and that the bar has a duty that's based on that foreseeability. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely correct. And I can sum this up I'm a big picture guy first. The district court and defense on this case is trying to have you focus on the individual himself. It's almost character picking on that the individual that brought him out, Mr. Brandt, along with Mr. Lunak, who was directed by the bar, took him outside. He was intoxicated, Mr. Friesen, the decedent. When he got outside, he was pushed and fell over. He was struggling on the way out. He was cursing. There were issues. What the district court relied on and is incorrect is that it's the potential harm that happened. So what that means is they focus on, was Mr. Brandt the pusher, I'll call him, was he a bad guy? Could they have seen he was a bad guy? And because he's a bad guy, this is going to happen. That's not correct. And I could be here for 2 hours, Your Honors. From page 17 on in my brief, what the real focus is, and this is what the law is, this goes back to Delwell, which is on page 18 in my brief. The law is that a particular act, not a person, the act, not a person, might result in injury. And if you go to page 18 in my brief, starting with the Christian case in 1896, which is still good law, it shows that the focus that the district court decided upon, that the exact potential harm, which is what they wrote, that's not correct. The law is clear, and this is what Henson talked about too. This is a twofold argument. If there are fact disputes, that's a question for the jury. What the district court did is they made factual findings that this individual was not dangerous. That's not what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to take this, and this is what the case law says, under Boone versus Martinez on page 17 and 18 of my brief, the dangerousness is based on the actions of the person undertook within the bar's sphere of influence.
I don't know that Boone is particularly supportive of your argument.
Well, I think Boone is not necessarily the decision, but follow me, Your Honor. The sphere of observation is a bigger picture. Once again, it's almost equating that if you're going to take an individual and say the individual that was the pusher in this case is a bad guy, you're going more even towards evidentiary findings of that's a character evidence almost. I've always giggled at this because it doesn't make sense that this area of law is focusing on something that facts are not allowed in cases. But the sphere of observation goes to everything else the facts are determined. It's what Henson, the Supreme Court, found, that there are questions here. If this is a close call and there are questions as to what was going on in the bar, should the bar have looked and seen that if you're not calling the authorities, which a bartender said they should have done, an employee's wife escorted him out, they had notice that this problem was going on.
But that's where I have problems. I don't think it's about notice of the of a problem. It's notice of the offending party's propensities. And I just don't see the authority for, instead of where the person who ultimately is the, I suppose, the victim, one would say, the injured party, we're looking at his propensities instead of the person who, as you said, the pusher.
But that's not what the law is, Your Honor. The law is
not that they're on notice of the offending party. That seems pretty straightforward.
But the offending party has to be looked at, and that's what my brief says. That's what I'm saying. I will not redo my whole brief in front of you. If you read page 17 till the end, it's about the circumstance that was going on. So what does that require, Your Honor, I'd ask? Does that require that a bar requires everybody to come in and have a background check to make sure if they're a good or bad person? That if they're loud or, I mean, the bar directed an individual to take a drunk, unruly patron after a bartender had already said we should have called the police, after the gaming manager said this guy's drunk, he could cause problems, after derogatory things were said, after when he is being escorted out by Mr. Lunak, connected to the bar itself, talked to his buddy Mr. Brandt to get him out. This is a bigger picture than just, oh, he's dangerous guy. That's what the case law interpreted, and that's what the facts of this case are, is there's a much larger sphere of influence in this case. In fact, you can take it one step further. The bar was sending somebody out to his vehicle on an icy night, intoxicated, didn't arrange for a ride for him, didn't ask if there's a friend to drive him home. We're basically pushing an intoxicated man out into the street to get rid of him. So you want to go to the sphere of influence? Or is that bar sending, and this isn't what happened, a drunk driver on the road without calling the authorities? I mean, that's why the Boone case, I think, does apply. That's where Henson applies. Henson had the exact same fact scenario, that this Henson was escorted out. The case is...
a third party who was injured in Henson.
I don't know that that makes a difference, Your Honor. I mean, my clients are the decedent's daughter and the decedent's wife.
I guess that's my conundrum here. You're kind of saying that the propensity of the offending party isn't relevant, that it's really a matter of foreseeability.
Well, I'm not saying it's not relevant, but what I'm saying is, I'll put it this way, the cases that have found unforeseeability in this vicious propensity are when, I'll give you an example, somebody leave, there was a fight, they kick the person out, and they come back later. The bar was not found to have a duty then. Similar to the last case, when does the timeline end? There's a timeline in these. The foreseeability is this action was all going on at the time, all going on at the time. And the bar had noticed that this guy might be dangerous. My client's spouse, or the decedent, that he was causing problems and they had to get him out. So what do? They ask somebody else to remove him, not the police. I think it's foreseeable on an icy night with a drunk individual where you have other people, including Mr. Brandt, drinking in the bar. That's in my brief as well. I won't get into that. But the fact you're sending an intoxicated man to bring another intoxicated man out, that this push or this would happen.
Seems to me that your argument would be the same even if the police showed up and the police escorted your client out and your client became belligerent with the police and there was a pushing and shoving that goes on, and everyone knows arrests are not always clean and neat and involving cooperative individuals. If your client would have fallen, if police were there, I assume it's no less foreseeable than that circumstance.
But I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I'll tell you why. Once the authorities are called, obviously I'm not going to sue the police during an arrest. There's an immunity issue there. And the bar has done their duty at that point. It's foreseeable that, hey, if we just take care of this on our own, something could happen. We need to call the authorities to take care of that. In that circumstance, I don't think the bar is negligent.
But that's my point. I don't think whether the officers are immune changes the concern I've got with your, with the possible same treatment for whether or not law enforcement are called. You're saying, well, you would have, I gather you're saying that the duty existed and would have been satisfied by calling the police. But if calling the police would have put your client potentially in the same circumstance, given that it's your client's sort of alleged sort of provocative behavior that led to this pushing and shoving, that could have occurred and might likely have occurred, maybe more likely to occur if law enforcement are involved.
But, Your Honor, I'll ask you a question. Doesn't that raise a fact question? That's a fact question. That's a jury question. That's too close. I can't answer that, and I don't think you can. I don't know what the police did. In this case, we had pushed my client onto the ice. I don't know if the arrest would have gone poor. I don't know if the bar would have been standing out there. I think that's a very different scenario.
No, my point, though, is that it sounds like foreseeability exists in both circumstances. And that's why you seem to be making a distinction between what calling the police or directing someone in the bar to escort an unruly person out. And if the harm would be the same, or the potential would be the same, or the foreseeability of injury would be the same, I'm not sure that advances your argument.
I don't know that I agree with you on that, Your Honor. I think once the police are called, the bar has done their duty to have an authority figure either arrest if this man is threatening, if he's this, and hopefully with the procedures that they've undertaken in police and how to arrest people and how to deal with people, that would have been different. Is something foreseeable? I don't know. That's a different case against the officer. I don't think I have a case against the bar at that point. I think where this is by saying, hey, get your buddy and get him out of here, and I listed a whole bunch of cases on the get him out of here. There's case law on that. That's where it changes it. They just, under, once again, this bigger sphere of influence, the foreseeability is not the foreseeability. This is an error of law that the district court created. This is what I want to make sure. I'm here on an error of law. It's an error of law that the trial court focused on the exact potential harm. That's not Minnesota law. The law is that it's on a particular act. That's what Henson, the Supreme Court, just decided, that these are fact disputes, that fact disputes, that when they're close and when there's evidence both ways, are a jury question. They are not a district court question. This case, and I understand counsel's arguments, she's going to say, well, we didn't know this guy was bad, and well, we didn't know this. Maybe, but that's not the law. That's not the law in front of you that you have to decide. The trial court and their argument focused on the exact potential harm of the individual. That's not the law. And that's what my brief, and once again, without staying up here for a half an hour arguing this, because there's replete case law since 1896 on this, that you must look at the bigger picture. You have an intoxicated man, my client. You have bar people that have said, get this guy out of here. He was around for a while. He was being obnoxious, I think were some of the words. I'm summarizing that. And when he was asked to get out after a bartender had said we should call the police, that didn't happen. They call a patron in the bar who is escorted out with Mr. Lunak, a connection to the bar, walks him to the door, and that's where this push occurs. That's foreseeable. That's not foreseeable as the potential harm, which the district court disregarded this with. That's the particular act, and that's the sphere of observation, the bigger picture on it. That goes towards all the case law that's out there. I just think that this was the focus of foreseeability is not this, Your Honors. I'm going to hold my hands up. It's not this, the individual. It's the individual in the bigger picture. And the example I'll use is me driving over here today. Is it foreseeable that because of the roads and snow that I had to take longer and that I could have gotten into a collision? Yes, that's what I'm arguing. It's not, was Mr. Slita going to get in his car on Kellogg Street and drive into a light post and do it? That's what the district court wants you to say, that because that specific act, that may not be foreseeable. But the fact you hit the roads and it's slippery is foreseeable. the fact you have an intoxicated man being escorted out of a bar by non-authorities, and by the way, the police station is three doors away almost from this VFW in Thief River Falls. It would have taken no time. It's the care and it's the sphere that should have happened. I have 30 seconds left, and I'm happy to come back for rebuttal, but I really think what needs to be focused on here is the district court made an error as to how they applied this, and that's your role here. Foreseeability is a bigger picture issue. It's this issue. It's not the issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You'll have additional time for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Kendra Olson, and I'm here today representing VFW Post 2793, which is in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. And we're here today to ask you to affirm the trial court's finding that summary judgment was appropriate in this case. The appellant's claim fails on the first element of innkeeper's negligence, which requires that the bar have notice of the offending party's dangerous propensities. There isn't another way to read that, and that is well-established case law throughout Boone versus Martinez into McLean Divine, into Henson versus Uptown Drink.
Can I just
Is that the only duty that the bar has to their patrons? Don't they have a duty to make sure that their patrons are kept safe? And if doesn't it change the facts or their liability if they take action to escort somebody out?
Well, couple of things. So to start with, first, this isn't a dram shop case. This is a straight-up innkeeper's negligence case. So the bar's duty here isn't really any different than any other business. And the general rule, of course, is that a business has no duty to protect its patrons from the violent or harmful acts of third parties. So in this case, the VFW has no duty to protect Mr. Friesen from acts done by Sean Brandt.
Okay. Well, hold on. Just so I could be clear on that, mm-hmm. Doesn't the fact that the relationship of these parties occurred at the direction of the bar change that equation?
Couple of things. It could. But... first of all, it's a disputed fact whether or not Sean Brandt was acting on the of his own volition or if he was acting at the behest of somebody at the VFW. I believe there is testimony in the record from Sterling Williams, who was an employee of the VFW but not working at the time. So
but this is summary judgment, so having disputed facts doesn't really help your cause here.
That's true, Your Honor. However, to get to my point, that is a disputed fact whether he was on whose behest he was acting. But we don't need to get there, and we don't get there because that's not how this case has been framed from the beginning. And it has always been framed as a innkeeper's negligence case, and that would be a change of legal theory at the appellate level that was not raised at the district court, which of course Thiele versus Stitch is the case that would point us to rule out that option. So turning away from the issue, it's been briefed extensively and talked about the issue about that first element.
Can I just ask you about some specific language in the Henson versus Uptown Drink case? Because this is the language that gives me pause with your argument where you're talking about, no, it's, you know, we need to focus on this individual. And there's a part of the case that says, when the totality of the facts and circumstances put the innkeeper on notice, we have held that there was a duty based upon foreseeability. I mean, that seems to say, we're not just looking at this individual, we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, which I think is what the appellant's arguing here. So why doesn't that part of the Henson versus Uptown Drink support appellant's position?
I guess my reading of Henson versus Uptown Drink is that Henson never once even addresses the first issue of the notice to the bar of the dangerous propensities of the offending party. And that's because in Henson versus Uptown Drink, the only element of innkeeper's negligence that was at issue was the foreseeability issue. So I believe that Henson versus Uptown Drink is trying to tell us that the totality of the circumstances can satisfy the foreseeability issue. But the totality of the circumstances can't provide notice of a person's dangerous propensities. And in Henson versus Uptown Drink, there were multiple actions by both Anderson and Sundby leading up to that incident that would have certainly provided notice of dangerous propensities.
So you're saying that later that this doesn't apply to, well, there's that special relationships, which goes to the innkeeper's duty to begin with, as opposed to later, if there is a special duty, then we eventually get to foreseeability. Am I understanding your argument correctly?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, without notice of the danger, how can an innkeeper be asked to act or not act or take reasonable steps? That is a threshold issue for a reason.
If the innkeeper is asking that the person leave, isn't that notice that they have to take care to make sure that nothing happens if they're the ones taking them out?
Well, it's certainly notice that there's somebody who's being offensive, but the point is that being offensive doesn't satisfy that first element of being the offending party for the purposes of negligence claim. So,
but you said it was like any other claim in any other business.
I guess I'm not following.
You said that the liability was just like any other business.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. So
are you adding a separate element for innkeeper liability?
Oh, no, that was for the discussion about whether or not we were in a premises liability situation or a more generic premises liability, which we're not. We're in an innkeeper's case. If we take the 30,000-foot view here, what we have is one person who is threatening the other bar patrons, who is cussing and generally being very inappropriate for the situation. I don't, what appellant's counsel seems to be arguing is that that person's safety is above the safety of those around him, which doesn't reconcile with what a reasonable person would do under the circumstances. And I think that goes to what you were just mentioning, Your Honor, about don't we have notice of a need to take action here? And the answer is, yeah, we do. But if the person that needs to be removed from the situation needs to be removed for a reason, and that reason is for the safety of the others who are around him.
Well, don't they have a duty to that person as well?
I don't know what that duty would be exactly.
Well, to make sure that the patron isn't injured.
It seems if
as long as they're on the property.
It seems if the patron has created his own emergency or created his own dangerous situation, he doesn't then get the benefit of...
But once something happens outside of the bar at the direction of the innkeeper, doesn't that create a different problem?
I think perhaps Your Honor is getting to almost the reasonableness prong, which is the third prong of an innkeeper's claim, that the tavern needs to take reasonable steps to protect its patrons. So that would probably be a fact question. Was the action reasonable? But we don't get there in this case because of that first element. Well, we don't need to get there. I think if we did, though, if we did get to that point under the circumstances, appellant's claim might be phrased as something that the VFW didn't do the right thing under the circumstances. They shouldn't have let Mr. Friesen be taken out of the bar. They should have just handled it differently. And there's two reasons why that doesn't work here. First, as an attack on really whether the VFW was behaving reasonably, it's the third prong. We don't need to get there. But also, second, that kind of analysis is really a but-for analysis that's inappropriate for summary judgment because it's almost like creating a butterfly effect, that if only the VFW hadn't taken this step and this step and this step, then maybe things would have turned out differently. So that kind of but-for analysis isn't really appropriate in this case. The question is, was what they did objectively reasonable? And I think it is objectively reasonable to say that they needed to place the safety of the other patrons in their bar ahead of that one person who was threatening them. And in this situation, the reasonable thing to do was to extricate him from the building. Also, to the point of appellant taking the position that was it reasonable to send this person out into the cold and into an icy parking lot, actually, if you check the testimony of, I don't remember whether it was Josiah Clark or Adam Main, one of them testified that it was their job as the designated driver. They were actually exiting the building at the same time as Friesen was being taken out so that they could go and get a vehicle to go and pick him up after he was taken outside. So even though I don't believe it was the VFW's responsibility to ensure his safety, there were steps being taken by those around Mr. Friesen. In order to protect, or at least, address the situation more fully than just literally throwing him to the curb. That's not exactly what was going on. Another issue that was raised by appellant, which is that the appellant has asserted that both Lunick and Brandt were inebriated. In appellant's brief, he states, Lunick was so inebriated that he only recalls bits and pieces of the evening because having had four or five drinks himself, his memory's foggy for the exact events. So there's two things I'd like to raise about this. So first, I'd encourage the court to review the transcript directly. Appellant's assertion that Lunick was so inebriated he could only remember bits and pieces is taken from a piece of transcript that reads as follows. Question, okay, and let's get to it. I'd like to draw your attention to late evening of December 16th and early morning of December 17th. Do you remember that day? Answer, bits and pieces. Question, bits and pieces. Answer, it's been a while. Doesn't have anything to do with him being inebriated, which means that there really isn't, is only inferences that can be drawn about whether or not Mr. Lunick and Mr. Brandt were inebriated. However, even if we accept it as true for the purposes of summary judgment and for plaintiff's assertion that these two folks who were asked to take him out of the building were intoxicated, there's nowhere in the record where it's indicated that that information is actually conveyed to somebody representing the VFW. If that information isn't received and understood and processed by the VFW, then for purposes of summary judgment, it doesn't matter, and it can't be taken into consideration. Finally, Your Honors, I will just conclude where I began with the first element of innkeeper's negligence. Dangerous propensities of the offending party. Even in their own, the plaintiff's own complaint, the offending party is alleged to be Sean Brandt, and there's been no provision of information about Sean Brandt's dangerous propensities that would put the VFW on notice of a need to protect anyone from him. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
My mother would be mad. I'm Dean Salita, and I represent the appellant. And I'm sorry I did not address the court with that originally. I think you've heard why this should be reversed and remanded. The totality of facts is the exact line from Henson. The totality of facts puts on notice based on foreseeability. Then the next question was, well, doesn't the bar, I don't know if you call it a special duty, but the fact that they undertook somebody in the bar to escort this person out gives some knowledge. It raises a different question. It raises a material issue as to where foreseeability came from.
Doesn't the propensity of that individual really drive the question? If not, why not?
Of which individual? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The escorter. You're saying that it matters as to foreseeability that the bar actually solicited an individual to escort your client out. So doesn't the propensity for danger of that individual play into foreseeability?
It's part of the bigger picture. It's part of the totality of facts. But the real issue is, does the bar know that something could happen here? So yes, the propensity for this to happen, but you have to remember, under the totality of facts, not just Mr. Brandt, Mr. Lunack, and this is directly in the transcript as well, at the doorway. Here we go. Here, as the men were leaving, they were observed to still be arguing and physically scuffling. At the doorway, Lunak, not just Brandt, Lunak, the one who's connected to the bar, and Brandt stabilized Friesen so he would walk upright with them. So the two issues you have here is I think you have a couple more fact disputes that were raised here today. You just heard there might have been a designated driver, and I made a general argument before. They didn't ask the designated driver to get rid of his friend to get him out of here. They asked a different patron. You asked the designated driver about this. That may take it differently. Totality of circumstances. Then it was raised by counsel that we don't know who actually asked if they asked him to get out. That's a material fact dispute as to the heart of this issue. And that was decided by the district court incorrectly and under the wrong standard. If the argument now is, well, maybe we didn't ask him to get out, he just did it on his own, that is a jury question, straight and true. And that's, we should not be here on a legal standard.
Ms. Olson said that you hadn't raised these issues before and that we shouldn't consider them. How do you respond to that?
That's what was argued at the district court. That's what my whole brief talked about. I mean, I don't understand that discussion. I mean, I guess if you want to point me which one you think. My brief talks about innkeeper negligence. That's what the case was about. It talks about foreseeability. That's what was brief. That's what was argued. That's what was discussed. That's what my appellate brief is. And that's what the facts are. And that's what this is. This was never on a dram shop case. It was never on a general negligence case. It was about the bar has a duty and is it foreseeable or not. I guess there are also inferences about who is inebriated or not. That's another fact dispute. There are fact disputes being brought up here today at the Court of Appeals. I would encourage you to read the transcript. I think it's pretty clear that there was a lot going on with Mr. Brandt being escorting him out, beginning with the fact that a bartender said that the police should have been called. Other patrons, including Mr. Williams, the gaming manager, said he's drunk. They used the get him out of here. They just undertook a higher duty once they asked to have him escorted out. They didn't call the police. They didn't ask his friend. They had notice. And at a minimum, this should be reversed and remanded because that's a foreseeability and a fact question. And that's what Henson says. I'll leave with this. The totality of the facts puts on notice based on foreseeability. Foreseeability is a jury question in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. The matter has been well briefed and well argued. The court will take this under consideration. An opinion will be issued within 90 days.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'll give everyone a moment to get settled. And I see there are two of you at council table for respondent. Are you dividing the argument in any way?
No, I'll just be sitting taking notes. Where would you like
to sit? Are you an attorney representing respondent? You feel free to sit there then. I just wanted to make sure that we divided the time if I needed to. So I think all of you are aware, very aware of our procedures, but each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself, since we are taping these proceedings when you come to the podium each time, and there is a switch on the podium. You can raise it or lower it to fit your needs. So whenever you're ready.